First case of the day is State on behalf of Jaquez G. versus Tebow. And is it Ms. Preisinger?
It is.
Good morning to you. You may approach. And you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sarah Preisinger. I'm an authorized attorney here on behalf of the state. I would like to reserve 2 minutes at this time for rebuttal, please. The crux of the issue before the court today has to do with service and paternity action. But I would urge this court to first consider, as a threshold issue, that summary judgment should not have been granted by the lower court in this case. Mr. Price was not entitled to summary judgment in this case because while the facts are not in dispute, the state of the law does not clearly entitle him to relief here. More specifically, the statutes as written in regards to this type of action and the appropriate service indicate that service as perfected by the state in the underlying case was proper. This original underlying action was filed by the state under Section 43.14.11, which in its last sentence speaks specifically to the appropriate type of service, specifically indicating that service shall be had as it is in other civil proceedings, which then takes us to 25.508.01, which again has clear language indicating that service on an individual may be had by personal, resident, or certified mail.
What was the address that you used for certified mail?
Your Honor, the specific address, I believe, is reflected in the record. It was an address that was confirmed by Mr. Price's probation officer at the time. That probation officer indicated that Mr. Price had provided that information to him as a point of contact and the address at which he received mail.
Were you aware that Mr. Price had been a party in other paternity actions?
My recollection is that there had been a previous case, I believe, in a year or two before the action in this case had been filed.
Do you know the addresses of where Mr. Price was living at that time?
I do not know the address of that case offhand. I would note, Your Honor, that there were two attempts at personal service made in this action. First, before the attempt at certified mail service, in which we were not able to serve Mr. Price successfully.
So it's your position you can choose then if you can't find him personally. Why did you even start to serve him personally? Could you just have served him by certified mail?
Certainly in these cases, we evaluate them on a case-by-case basis based on the facts and the information available to us at the time.
What do you want from this court?
I believe that...
It's not disputed that this is not the father. He's not the father.
It is correct, Your Honor, that ultimately...
So what do you want?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that while ultimately genetic testing did exclude Mr. Price as the father, the original service was appropriate, and based on that original service...
So you want that window where he was? You want to collect, what, $1,000?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that the arrears are appropriately preserved because I believe that Mr. Price's best remedy is under 43.14.12.01, rather than under the general equity statute, that it would be appropriate for him to pursue his remedy at law.
What equity does the state have in this case? The mother falsely accused him of being the father. He wasn't the father. He basically has been in and out of court because he can't pay the amounts that he's required to pay. What's the state's equity in this, and what is your real interest in this case?
In this case, Your Honor, as in all the cases my office handles, we always want to do our best to ensure that we are in proceeding in against the correct parent, which is why...
Once you got a determination from the trial court on this issue, what's your interest in trying to collect $1,000 from this guy, knowing that he's not the father?
And it is the state's position that because he was appropriately served and frankly sat on his rights for a period of years, that he was the legally responsible party at the time, and should he wish to ask the court for relief, the way for him to do so is via 43.14.12.01, which offers additional protections.
How did he eventually end up with a counsel that would represent him to protect his rights?
I apologize, Your Honor.
Well, go ahead. Was he at a contempt hearing?
He was, Your Honor. He was, the original documents in this case that he was served with included a notice of right to counsel, which he did not at that time exercise. My recollection is that in 2012, there were contempt actions filed both on this case and two companion cases. Mm-hmm. At that time, Mr. Price did exercise his right to counsel. Ultimately, that attorney moved for genetic testing, and that was at that time Mr. Price was excluded.
I'd like to take you back to the certified mail service. Has Mr. Price, in the evidence that was offered in the proceedings to vacate the judgment, ever denied that he received that certified mail service?
My recollection of the record is that he has indicated that he has not denied it was, in fact, his mailing address, that he had provided that information to his probation officer at the best point of contact for mail, but he has indicated that he has stated to the court that he did not receive that document.
Was that under oath?
Not to my recollection, Your Honor. It is also my understanding that the person who signed for that certified mail has passed away since that time and can provide no direct evidence as to that point.
So what do you think the record shows on that service?
I think the record indicates that that service was proper under the statute. The language of 25-508-01 does not express a preference for one method over the other. It does not indicate, as in the statutes for mailing and leaving, that there's any need for the state or the moving party to ask for additional leave to proceed with one type of service over another. And certainly, as I indicated in these cases, we consider them on a case-by-case basis. And
well, do we require personal service in a dissolution action?
There is, in Chapter 42, there is a requirement in such a in a dissolution action that service either be personal or that there be leave from the court. But I do believe that those two chapters can be distinguished. In frankly, not based on...
Well, you do have a statute that provides how you serve in a paternity action, don't you? That's the main distinction.
Beg your pardon?
That would be the main distinction.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so. And also the fact that in the dissolution of a marriage, there are other issues for the parties to that case to resolve, including the dividing of property, other things like that. And I would note...
What's proper service when you in a modification
in a
conventional dissolution docket?
My understanding in a dissolution action, if there is to be a modification action filed, then those original requirements from the dissolution are appropriate.
They're brought forward again?
Yes.
Okay.
That they require either that personal service or leave. However, I do think that it is distinguished based on essentially the type of action and the type of relief that parties are asking for from the court. That 42, again, allows parties to divide property and do other things and does not make a distinction as to the type of service required based on whether or not there are children. That if there is a marriage to dissolve, then service is required personally or by leave from the court. But that distinction does not exist in 43. And as I think there is a statute that specifically indicates the appropriate method of service, that it appears clear that the legislature intended them to, that the requirements of 43 speak for themselves.
So in your view, analogizing to the service requirements in dissolutions is not productive because we're in a paternity statute?
Yes, Your Honor. I think
and paternity statutes are what, in derogation of the common law?
No, but I think they do specify.
They're strictly construed?
I think they, when you read them as a whole, they speak for themselves. They indicate that method of service is clear, that when you look at this at the service statute in 25-508-01, it doesn't include those further limitations or other requirements that you ask the court for further leave. That essentially, that based on the situation at hand and the facts available to the moving party, that a different type of service may be appropriate and may be most reasonably calculated to allow that parent the opportunity to participate, be aware of the action, voice any objections, and frankly, in this scenario, ask for genetic testing initially rather than waiting a period of years before bringing that request to the court.
Do you know whether the requirement of personal service in a dissolution action was something that the legislature just carried over from the old divorce statutes into the relatively new statute in the mid-1970s in the no-fault statute?
That information I do not know, Your Honor. I apologize, although I do believe...
Assume that that's the case. Wouldn't that suggest that the legislature was simply reflecting what some may now view as an antiquated view of the value of a marriage and the importance of marriage, and that if marriage is going to be dissolved, personal service is going to be required?
Your Honor, I think that more importantly than that possible carryover is the fact that the language of 43 specifically does not require it.
So by the time the paternity statutes came around, the legislative attitudes had changed vis-a-vis the importance of service requirements.
I think possibly, Your Honor, that maybe that the legislature was recognizing that sometimes parents, unfortunately, in paternity actions do avoid service, and that it may not be as simple as serving a party only personally. In a divorce action, presumably one parent, or one party, I should say, knows information about the other party, and unfortunately, that's not always the case in the actions.
Thank you,
Your Honors. I'd like to reserve my remaining time.
Thank you very much. Ms. Owen, good morning to you.
Good morning. Kate Owen, Legal Aid of Nebraska. We represent Appellee. May it please the court. Procedural due process requires personal service in a paternity case.
Let's back up for a second. What's the statutory requirement for service in a paternity case?
The statutory requirement is service on an individual.
And it's not, it
as
doesn't,
otherwise provided.
It does not require personal service,
it does
correct?
Not explicitly require it, that is correct.
And the attempt to import that in from the dissolution statutes has no textual support in the statutes, correct?
What I would respond to on that is that in the dissolution statute, you can't get a child support order without personal service. You can file your dissolution complaint and serve it. If you don't have personal service, you will not get a child support order.
That's because you don't have personal jurisdiction.
That's because you don't have personal jurisdiction.
You can get in rem jurisdiction over the marriage itself, but without personal jurisdiction. But in virtually every other type of case, you don't have to have personal service. You can have service by certified mail, service by leaving, if the person is of sufficient age. I mean, those are the standards for service in Nebraska, right?
That is correct, unless you're dealing with child support. A modification requires personal service.
That's but not that's just, back in the
it's
dissolution
not,
statute.
It's not just in the dissolution statute. It's actually, it carries over to the dissolution statute from Chapter 43. When the state moves to modify a child support order, it refers you to Chapter 42, the modification section, which says, under subsection 6, service shall be as in dissolution actions.
When the state moves to modify a paternity child support order?
Yes. Personal service is required.
But not for an initial?
Right. Which would be our point, that that does not make sense statutorily.
Well, but
you also need personal service to terminate parental rights. Establishment should require nothing less.
That last part is your narrative.
Which, yes, that is absolutely my narrative. That is our point, though. The procedural due process, well, first, let me give you this site. It's 43-512-15, which is in the paternity section, which refers you to 42-364.
But correct me if I'm, the U.S. Supreme Court has never said, have they, that personal service is absolutely required. It's service reasonably calculated to provide actual notice.
That is correct.
So you're wanting to add this sort to take a statutory provision in the dissolution statutes to import it in under the rubric of due process, and I'm just having trouble. And I would repeat the question I asked you, that I asked your opponent to you, and that is, did your client ever under oath deny that he actually received that summons that was served on his grandmother?
He filed an affidavit under oath in which he said he did not have notice of the order.
Is that in our record?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know what the exhibit it is?
I do not.
All right. Thank you.
It is our position that procedural due process would require personal service of a dissolution. I'm not trying to carry over the statute. It exists independently.
Could the legislature change the requirement for dissolutions from in dissolution actions from personal service to any type of permitted service?
I don't think that that would comport with due process, no.
So, and again, from where are you drawing this due process analysis where the U.S. Supreme Court has never said personal service is required? It's only notice reasonably calculated to provide actual notice.
It has not been before the United States Supreme Court on a paternity issue. In Little versus Streeter, the court did find that an indigent defendant had procedural due process rights to genetic testing. In Carroll versus Moore, this court did find that an indigent defendant has constitutional rights to an appointed counsel.
Before he's put in prison.
Those have no value if you don't know that you've been sued. What good are those procedural safeguards if I never have notice? I was not personally served with this paternity complaint.
I guess, counsel, are you going to candidly admit you're asking us to extend the due process jurisdiction?
I think this would be consistent with the jurisprudence that this court has already had in place. I don't think that it would make sense to have less protection at the beginning than the end.
Well, you're not necessarily going to be put in jail at the beginning. That was the Carroll versus Moore. We're not going to let people be put in jail unless they're being represented by counsel, or at least have the opportunity to be represented by
counsel. Absolutely. But if you don't receive the complaint, and you don't receive the notice that you're entitled to counsel, a default judgment is entered against you, and a monetary judgment is accruing, your procedural due process has not been served.
And ultimately what then happens is when this is enforced, counsel is appointed, as you were, and these rights are then protected. You had an opportunity to seek vacation of the judgment, correct?
Yes, and we are, to be clear, we are not the public defender, but he did have a public defender appointed, yes. And a motion to vacate was filed. He filed it pro se within a year of the initial entry of order. He just did not have the legal sophistication to litigate that. My point would be that in Anthony K. versus State, this court held, even though certified mail was appropriate for service on an individual, procedural due process was not satisfied. And this court
that was the termination case.
No, that is a case where,
In your procedural due process, are you arguing there are three issues that you look at in considering due process, the state's interest, the
private interest,
and?
And the erroneous deprivation versus the probable benefit that in this case is personal.
And you would say that the state's interest in this case is fairly minimal, right?
It is. It is primarily financial, although our Supreme Court of the United States has noted, and again in Little versus Streeter, the state has an interest in identifying the correct biological father. But yes, it's financial, and the state has until the child is 18.
Well, how did Mr. Pierce first get notice of this judgment or paternity action?
It was not in the record. The inference is that it was from a wage garnishment.
Oh, from garnishment, that's when. So on January 7th of 2010, then he filed a motion to vacate, but it never got anywhere.
Right.
Is the motion in the record?
Yes.
So what does he allege in his motion?
That there was no jurisdiction over his
person. Because?
Because of failure of service.
That was in the 2010 motion?
That's in his pro se motion. And it's our position
What's the legal significance of that?
Of his pro se motion? I honestly don't think there is a lot of significance. The state
was it a voluntary appearance?
No, because the judgment was void.
So that's the legal significance.
That's the legal significance. Thank you. My point being, I think the equity of whether he was sitting on his rights is irrelevant. There was no valid judgment against him. I think the disestablishment statute is also relevant. Whether it provides an adequate legal remedy or not only matters if there was a valid judgment to begin with. Without service.
Well, he doesn't really have the same remedy because he can only vacate from the date he files his application to do
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. That is our point. Nothing will fix that arrearage, even though.
Is the arrearage from the date of the determination or is the arrearage from the date he files a motion to vacate?
It would be from when he filed his complaint to disestablish.
So that was back in 2010.
He filed a motion to vacate that was never noticed or served, so I don't know what the court would be. It was a couple years later when his public defender served. Noticed.
And that would be in your view, that would stop the arrearages?
In my view, there is no arrearage because there was no valid judgment.
If any.
Okay. Without service over a person to create a parent-child relationship is not something that this court's jurisprudence would allow. When you look to the other factors under the Matthews versus Eldridge factors, the parent-child relationship is a fundamental constitutionally protected right, as is his liberty interest to not having a money judgment for a child that is not his, for doing jail time on contempt of an order that he had no actual notice of. Personal service is a de minimis safeguard to put in place for the state to accomplish. Again, it has 18 years to find the biological father of this child, and it can go back retroactively and get child support that entire period of time. That's a huge procedural advantage in a very lopsided scheme to begin with.
Did you say, I'm sorry, I'm backing up just a little bit, that you think it's inappropriate in a due process context to create a parent-child relationship by publication?
Without personal service.
Without personal service.
Yes.
Okay, but you could terminate a parent-child relationship by publication? Without personal service, do you agree that is a correct statement of the law? Okay, and what's the basis?
I don't have the termination site in front of me. I apologize.
Did your client...
But I know it is in the case.
Did your client ever treat... Was there a father-child relationship at all?
There's no relationship. As always, known, there was no biological possibility of this being.
Can an adoption go forward with a second parent by publication to a purported parent?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, did this child support affect his ability to pay child support for his other children?
Yes.
So would that be another interest that would be considered?
That is absolutely a private interest.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have time for rebuttal?
37 seconds.
37 seconds, Ms. Kreisinger.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would urge this court to consider, as I believe, Justice Castle, you observed, that procedural due process requires that a party be, notice be, the service be reasonably calculated to provide the party a notice of the action and an opportunity to participate. And I would contend that in a situation where a parent is served by certified mail at his verified, undisputed mailing address, it is virtually axiomatic that he has been granted both that notice and that opportunity to participate. And the fact that Mr. Price did not do so in this case does not necessarily indicate that that service was inappropriate. And I would contend that under the statutes as plainly written, that service was absolutely appropriate. Thank you very much for your time today, Your Honors.
Thank you. That takes us to the next case of the day, which is Hartley versus Hartley.